This is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into yet another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nestler. Beginning May 18th, I'll be away for 5 weeks, so I want you to enjoy these Express Yourself conversations from the past year. You'll hear some live music also from Steve's guitars, courtesy of Grassroots Television, and a very special live show from the Glenwood Summer of Jazz. Someone described the music of Western centuries as honky-tonk music with vocabulary. Well, that just about nails the sound of Western centuries. And they paid a visit to Express Yourself just a couple weeks ago before their gig at Steve's Guitars and lugged in a pedal steel, which gives their music that psychedelic, mournful edge that's so crucial to their sound. Here they perform Wild You Run to start today's show.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1. From the forecast of so swiftly did you run, just like the prodigal son. Dreams beguiled, so easily spent, and up around the bend, temptation smile. Oh! I won't tell mama what you've done. Go have your fun while wild you run. But when your restless body cries out for its soul to find its strong cold. Well, 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 well. Oh, Jimmy.
Mama, what you've done, go hell, yeah.
KDNK's Claire DeLarve spoke to painter Terry Gardner on December 14th, 2017, right before his appearance in the very prestigious Coors Western Art Show.
We're sitting here with painter Terry Gardner, born and raised in Missouri and then called to Colorado to paint the outdoors and develop an intimate relationship with the land and life of the West. Gardner's compositions are born from his surroundings, but evolve in his studio to a place that is darker and deeper, where mystery and contemplation are nurtured. Gardner's work tells the story of the American West, rich yet young in scale and alive with industries and lifestyles that most tend to think of as history. Good morning, Terry. Welcome to KDNK. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to sharing a little bit about the inside of my work.
Wonderful. So what is it about the West and its spirit that has captivated you since childhood?
A family vacation was, I think, instrumental at a young age. We went to Colorado, and I was pretty struck by the open space and the mountains, and it was just something I hadn't seen growing up in Missouri. So I think that was pretty instrumental. And I think another aspect of the West that really intrigued me was Western television and Western movies. I used to watch Gunsmoke with my father. I liked Alias, Smith and Jones, and Jeremiah Johnson was a movie that really kind of captured my interest and spirit of the West. And I think those were, at the time, you don't realize how much of an influence they have on you. But as you grow older, you just realize what you're doing as a child from even an entertainment or media perspective that's beginning to have an influence on your interest. So I think that's a little bit about what captivated my spirit as a young person.
Okay. So over the years that you've been painting, how do you see the boundaries between Western landscapes and human influence changing?
Well, I think that's an excellent question in terms of how it relates to my work, because what's really intriguing about the West is that it is so, there's so many industries and interests that pull at the heart of people in this country. I think it's both about its recreation, it's the outdoors, it's conservation, it's wildlife, it's industries such as mining and wind and gas, and all those are very relevant topics to this day. And then you think about what brought a lot of people to the West, the gold rush and the chance to homestead and have your own piece of land to farm, and the ranching and the cattle and all those industries that may have taken place or brought people westward in the 1800s, they are still very relevant to this day. And I think sometimes they feel like they're often at odds with each other. You can find sometimes that ranchers can be really instrumental in conservation and caring about the land just as much as a conservationist. And a lot of times you're seeing in current events that those industries have to come together to find a common ground so that the industries can potentially survive, but they can also help each other out in preserving land or helping each industry. And I think that's a really interesting aspect about the West. Those industries haven't gone away. They just have evolved.
Right. The evolution of Colorado. It's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
And it's nice that
everybody is working together to preserve this land that's so precious to us all.
Yeah, and one of the organizations I work with as a guest artist is Ranchlands, who operates multiple ranches in the West, both in Colorado and New Mexico. And they're huge ranches, but they have a vested interest in the future of ranching and making sure that they don't overgraze or really respect the native grasses and the land itself. And that is a intriguing aspect of kind of ranching and where it's going. And I will be involved in a show coming up in 2018 that has a lot to do with the future of ranching. But it has changed a great deal over the past 100 years.
Right. So your paintings depict scenes that feel so familiar to us here in Colorado, from the bristlecone pines to ranchers and cattle meeting in the open plains. And what is it about these characters that inspire you, and what inspires you to choose the subjects of your paintings?
Well, it's I like open space. I like getting out and seeing where there is both the evidence of man, sometimes not so much, but that, as we just discussed, the changing of the West, and certainly the population is growing immensely. I think it's also what influences my subject is not just being void of human presence, but how is it interacting? What's that dance between civilization and nature? And I think ranching is a big part of that, where you have this opportunity to witness brandings or these roundups and watch the cowboys and the cowgirls do a very hard and difficult job, but it's being close to nature at the same time, but witnessing an industry. Whereas when I am intrigued by trees or the bristlecone pines, which is something that's really touches my soul in terms of those trees. They are the oldest living trees on the planet, and most of my subjects for the bristlecone pines come from Bristlecone Scenic Area, which is just near Alma, just south of Breckenridge. These trees have survived thousands of years, and the oldest ones are in California. There are ones in Colorado that are dated over 2,000 years old, but they've survived fires and droughts and some very difficult weather implications, but also even miners have taken some of these trees down to build mines, but they have survived, they persist, they are kind of spiritual in nature. So these subjects that I do can be very vast, but they all are part of what I like and am intrigued about is the American West. It's a very diverse land. It's got a lot of stories to tell, and that's what I try to do with my work, is make sure that there's a richer story and there's some aspect that pulls the viewer in and kind of prompts some contemplation about the actual subject depicted.
Right, you really have us thinking about where history meets the modern world, and that they're all still coexisting, of course. So, do you paint for collectors or for yourself?
Well, I there's a quote by Oscar Wilde that I have on my studio wall that I think is really important for both the artist and the collector. It's his words are, "A true artist takes no notice whatever of the public. The public are to him non-existent." And while that may seem like there's a bit of arrogance to it, it's really important that an artist is about truth to himself and what it is he's trying to say. And if you're a collector, you want to support an artist that's really being true and not chasing the winds of time or any kind of trends. And I really do try to paint for myself. However, never underestimate the importance of collectors and patrons of the arts when it comes to supporting artists so that they can scratch out a living. It is not an easy thing to do, but I really try to stay true to myself and just paint for myself.
Good. Well, we're so glad that you do.
Thank you.
So some of your landscapes are very much in the style of the French Barbizon painters who lived and worked in the mid-19th century, like Rousseau, Corot, Millet. Yet being an artist in this century has a new set of rules applied to the game. Tell us how you see tools like social media. Do you think social media is a blessing or a curse? And how do galleries play a role in making your art known and appreciated?
Well, the comparison to Corot and Millais, I think, is I'm humbled by that. They're masters and well respected. And while I am typically looked upon as a representational painter, I often describe myself more in the lines of a tonalist painter because of my palette. But back to that quote about Oscar Wilde and the artist really being true to himself and taking no notice whatever of the public, I think that's what's really important as an artist. And it wasn't easy for me to really come to that resolve that I can't be influenced by certain genres of painting and what's popular. There is some feedback I get and discussions where we see the younger generation looking more to abstract art, and I think it's become a little bit more heightened in its popularity. But I can't chase that if it's not what I really want to do as an artist. I have to be true to myself, and I think it's important when I'm trying to tell a story and make a connection with a viewer or a patron, I have to do what works for me, and what works for me right now is doing work that is representing a place or a space or a subject, and that's super important to me. And I'm not going to kind of veer off that course at this current time. As far as how the tools of social media, you could probably make a case that there are challenges and things that are not good, but there are things that are very good. We can all publish our work and we can get it out there and so forth. I try not to be necessarily influenced by that. Some artists are better than others at using the social media as a tool. There are pros and cons on both sides. And on your final question about gallery. Galleries are super important. However, they have their challenges as well. It's the market has certainly changed. We've lost a lot of galleries in the past 10 years because of the online presence of artists and the ability for artists to sell directly or online galleries. But physically seeing the work is still important, making that personal connection. What I love about painting is there's texture and substance that you can see in a work of art that often you can't see online. You can't see a 4-foot by 6-foot painting and experience it the same way online that you can in a gallery. So the physical space is very important, and I hope that as we see the gallery world evolve, there's still many places for collectors to go see the actual work.
Right, it's true that when you're standing in front of these paintings, especially oil paint, to see the brush strokes and the physical texture of the paint, I mean, that's unparalleled, and it certainly can't be replicated digitally. I mean, you know, when you're looking at something on a screen versus in person, it's a whole different experience.
It is, Claire, and I think it's an important aspect. When people have asked me, do you do reproductions or giclées to make your work attainable to those that are either young collectors or those that don't have perhaps the financial means to buy a larger painting, I have refrained at this time because, first off, there's a lot of great work out there, and I do appreciate those that actually buy original work, and I try to just do a painting in itself, and that texture, that substance that you see on the actual canvas, the dripping of the paint, or it's almost the raised up brush strokes that are visible, are what make paintings more unique now than ever. because we are seeing so much work online and pixels are representing it. But what is the actual art in the end if you're just seeing it on a monitor and then it goes away briefly and then it's in a cloud somewhere for years and years to come? And I think that using the senses and the touching and seeing and feeling those works of art is super important.
So is that your favorite element of oil painting? Is that why you chose that as a medium? The ability to build up the textures and really feel, make the scene dimensional.
That is a very important aspect of it. But probably it's because I started working in oil at a young age. My father was a commercial artist, and I got a oil paint set. Yeah, one of those paint-by-number sets when I was very, very little. And it was really just kind of this bug that I caught, and it stuck with me. And I always just loved oil paints. I actually love the smell of the oil paints. I love that you're able to work with them longer than, say, an acrylic or watercolor as far as their drying time. And managing the drying time is one of the important elements of producing a piece of work. The summer, hotter temperatures, the paint dries faster, colder temperatures in the winter in the studios, paints seem to dry longer. So you kind of have to manage that. And that's part of what I love, though, is just the extended drying time and the texture and layering of paint and bringing that aspect that we discussed as far as being able to see and feel and giving it some more dimension.
So with this extended drying time, it seems like it would be even more difficult to determine when the work is finished. How do you know when it's done?
Yeah, that's an important piece that any artist would tell you is sometimes a joke, because we always say there's two people that need to do a painting, one to do the actual painting and another person to hit you upside the head when it's done so you don't overwork it. And that is a risk often that artists take with their work, is going too far and being able to step away from it when it just feels right. And I think that that's the answer to the question, is you work it and you take it on this journey and you go with it on this journey, but at some point you just have to feel like this is where I'm happy with it. It's what the vision I had when I started the piece. It's what I'm trying to say, and you step away from it. I learned a great deal reading about de Kooning and how his process was painting and scraping and applying drawings that he worked on over top and all sorts of different kinds of tools. And that is part of the process. Sometimes you put colors next to each other that work, or certain textures, then you pull it back off, and it really is an interaction with your canvas as you develop a piece of work.
So what do you find you're still learning about the process?
Patience. While you can't work on pieces for forever, you do have to be patient, because a piece of work, a painting, it sometimes is like a road trip, where you have one day where it's good, or the next day you have bad weather, or you veer off course. But you have to just kind of be patient and trust yourself in the process, and be willing to, if it's not going the direction or what your original intentions were, you have to kind of step back or course correct. But it's the process and being patient is one aspect of it. There's another aspect that I also think is really important, is what I call mind noise. This kind of relates to that Oscar Wilde quote about not taking any notice whatever of the public, but the mind noise is something that it doesn't matter what industry you're in, is that you have those thoughts of like, oh, what's someone so going to say about this? Is the are the collectors going to like this? Are gallery owners going to like this? So forth. And it's really just being in that zone where you block out any kind of distractions or noise and really just get into the flow of doing your painting and that process. And the time just goes by so beautifully because you're just really connected.
That's wonderful. So as a self-employed artist, you're not locked into a 9-to-5 kind of a work schedule. So what time of day are you most inspired to paint in the studio and then outdoors?
I am in the studio pretty early in the morning. I have 3 kids. I take them to school because of my flexible schedule. So right after I take them to school, I get into the studio. It's also the best time for lighting. Natural light is important. I do a lot of color mixing and really want to check those values and the temperatures of those colors as I'm putting them on the canvas. So having good natural light is important. And when we get to this time of year, really working from like 8 to 3 is probably the best time. It starts getting dark fairly early, so you start losing that light late afternoon. You have more of a work time, longer studio time in the summer. But I definitely work during the day when I have good natural light. And when it comes to the outdoor work, it's when I get on those little 3-4 day journeys and have a chance to get away and go experience a new location in the mountains or out on the plains or visit one of the ranches down in near Pueblo or near the sand dunes. It's again during the day, but those little times when you can get away and experience subjects firsthand are invaluable.
And what is your favorite way to capture the scene when you are outdoors on these trips?
I used to do a lot of fine air painting. However, now I've evolved to where I use drawing materials, and I do a lot of sketching, which is an important part of the process in doing painting. The plein air work, I felt sometimes like I was rush to do this painting and you only have a window of time, whereas I just wanted to kind of have the chance with drawing to see and experience the surroundings and do more looking and feeling of what the subjects are. And that's what I do now, and I also, photography is an important part of it. However, when I get back to the studio, it's the combination of looking at the photos, looking at the drawing, and then evolving the process where I mix colors and start developing what that palette's going to be. And there's a lot of work that's done before you actually put paint to canvas.
So you don't just sit there and make the magic happen. It's nice that there's such a process, and it's all by your hand, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and charcoal, whether I'm using charcoal on location or doing further drawings in the studio with charcoal, I draw it out. I can use blending sticks and erasers and kind of move the charcoal around a little bit. And sometimes you mess them up and you throw them away, and then you do another one, and then it's like you captured what you were looking for, that ethereal quality in the scene, and that's the point where you feel like, all right, I'm ready to take this to color and develop this into a larger piece.
Over the years, I'll bet Eliza Gilkison has visited KD&K at least 10 times. This time she visited Express Yourself on August 6th of 2014, and she performed Slouching Toward Jerusalem before her gig at Steve's Guitars.
People get ready, cause it won't be long, for the hurricanes will be blowing strong, and chance to rise will be coming gone when he's slouching towards Bethlehem. What kind of beast comes slouching? What kind of beast comes slouching? What kind of beast comes slouching? Slouching towards Bethlehem. He's coming in the name of hunger, dragging all the poor folks under. Who stands behind him, I wonder? Slouching towards Bethlehem. Sing, what kind of beast comes slouching? What kind of beast comes slouching? What kind of beast comes slouching? Slouching toward Bethlehem. He's coming in the name of high finance, corporations, religion, and violence. He's counting on collusion and silence. Slouching towards Bethlehem. What kind of beast comes slouching? What kind of beast comes slouching? What kind of beast comes slouching? Slouching towards Bethlehem. You better stand with your shoulder to the wheel. You better band together at the top of the hill. You better blow that horn much louder still. Slouching towards Bethlehem. Say, what kind of beast come? Ooh, what kind of beast come slouching? What kind of beast comes slouching, slouching toward Bethlehem, slouching toward Bethlehem, slouching toward Bethlehem.
Local landscape painter Dan Young visited Express Yourself on August 4th, 2017, right after the opening of his exhibition at the Cora Logos Gallery in Basalt. Colorado native Dan Young is in the third decade of a career as a landscape artist. He has representation in 8 galleries across the West. His work has appeared in at least 5 magazines devoted to Western art. Dan, welcome to KD&K.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Are you happy with the show?
Yeah, absolutely. I had a great turnout last night. Nice. I was very pleased.
How many pieces are in the...
I gave them 19 new paintings.
New. Wow, so you've been a busy man.
Yeah, whenever I'm having a show, I try to give them new work. So,
How long does it take to make a Dan Young landscape painting?
That's a good question. Sort of depends on what kind of a day I'm having. Uh-huh. On a good day, I might get one done. Sometimes I can beat on them for a week or a month, so... It varies.
Well, you're known as a plein air artist.
That is correct, yes.
These look like oil paintings,
though. They're all definitely oil paintings.
Isn't it hard to do an oil painting in plein air?
Not at all. It's actually one of the easiest.
Really? I would think pastels, because they dry so quickly. But no.
Well, no, but pastels, you have to layer colors. Uh-huh. So when you're trying to get a specific color out there, you have to layer multiple sticks to get it the right color. Where I get to look out there, figure out what color it is, mix it up on my palette, and put it on the panel.
Wow. How long does it take oil paint to dry?
It depends. In the summer, it'll dry a lot quicker, within 2 days. But in the winter, it could be a week. So it's actually a chemical change. It doesn't dry. So humidity, temperature, things like that have a lot to do with it.
Do you sketch first on the canvas, or do you just go right to the paint?
No, I don't. I don't sketch on the canvas, but I always do what's called a thumbnail drawing, which is a small drawing. They call them thumbnails because they're supposed to be the size of your thumbnail, but I actually do them larger than that. So I work out the composition in a small drawing.
Uh-huh. Well, I noticed on your website, which, by the way, is danyoungstudio.com, that you have 62 archived paintings on there.
That could be, yeah. I'm just glad someone's looking at my website.
Well, yeah, of course. And, you know, they're gorgeous palette.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're not afraid to paint water. There's water in a lot of them.
Not at all. You know, the more you do this, the more you challenge yourself. I've been painting for about 30 years now. And when you start out, you tend to avoid those things that you don't think you can pull off.
Uh-huh.
And over time, the more experience you have, the more challenges you take on. And I'm to the point in my career where I love a challenge. I'll try it at least once.
Okay. Huh. How many times did you have to try painting water before it worked?
Oh, my goodness. A lot more than once. And
yeah.
Then it was snow, and then it was painting at night. And uh-huh. I'm one of those artists that I sort of focus on something. It might be night scenes, or it might be water paintings or snow paintings, and I'll go after it full bore for several months until I sort of reach a peak, and then I move to something new.
Uh-huh. I noticed a lot of snow paintings.
Yeah, I love painting snow. It's
Why?
Probably my favorite.
Why?
It's the challenge of it. When I first started, it's like, well, snow is white, so I'll just go out, take my white paint, and paint snow. Well, if you go out and stand in snow, which I have done for countless hours, and freeze your fingers and your toes, you start to learn to observe quickly and paint quickly.
Uh-huh.
And I've always loved the challenge of snow. So it's definitely where I really thrive to do my best work is in the winter.
You know, when you say that, I think of that old saw of, what is it, 90 different words for snow in
the Eskimo language.
Yes. And I imagine there's 90 different ways to paint snow.
There really is. And then I got the wild hair to see if I could paint it at night under a full moon.
Wow.
And then all bets were off. So it's been a challenge, but I really, like I say, I'm one of those artists that I go after something. So I would go out at night after night in a full moon in the winter and try to figure out what snow does at night.
How about that? Well, I noticed 5 or 6 paintings at night, but I don't remember any of them being snowbound.
There's probably some on there if you look, but that's okay. Something I sort of got known for is doing those.
Huh. Known how? What do you mean?
Well, in other words, when you're an artist, you get known as a specific artist doing a specific subject matter. What I have tried to do is avoid being pigeonholed. There's nothing worse when your gallery says, give us another one of those snow paintings because we know we can sell it. Well, you know, I have to sell my paintings to make a living, but I also like the challenge of doing different subjects. Like, say, right now I'm into horses. A lot of my paintings in this show have horses in them. So it's just something new for me. It's a new challenge.
I'm guessing that you're out there plein air, you're painting, and you've got a very intense focus on what your subject is, whether it's a horse or a mountain or a stream. And my experience with intense focus is that it's transcendent. There's a quality, and it doesn't happen right away, but there's a quality that kind of carries you away. Is that your experience with your painting?
As you're speaking, I'm shaking my head, which I'm sure they're not seeing. But you're absolutely right. You almost get into a zone, if you will. I mean, I'm in my own world out there, and I could tell you countless stories where people have walked up behind me and said something and just sent me out of my shoes because I never heard them, you know. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It becomes a focus, you know, and the longer you can keep that concentration, you sort of get on a roll, if you will.
Did you ever see something that maybe wasn't there because of that focus? Did a door of perception open?
You know, that's one I haven't experienced. But the interesting thing is, Ben, that you mentioned that, even though I paint from life or I paint existing subject, I still use a lot of artistic license. I move mountains. I move trees. I change things. I make a painting out of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I've said before, Mother Nature, I can't outpaint her, so I just use her as a guideline.
That's a great line, and it never occurred to me. You know, you think of artistic license with movies and books, but not necessarily with landscaping.
Well, absolutely. Most people think you just set up and paint exactly what you see. And when I started as an artist, that's exactly what I did.
Uh-huh.
I went out trying to copy Mother Nature, and I learned that it's really about my interpretation of Mother Nature. So when I go out now, I base it off a scene. But like I say, I'll move mountains. I'll put things in that aren't there. I'll take things out that don't work. I make paintings when I'm outside as opposed to copy what I see.
I've always conceived of painting as a very emotional exercise. Is that your experience?
It is. And me, from an artist standpoint, what I really try to do is strike that viewer on an emotional level. In other words, when a viewer comes up to me and says, oh, that snow painting, it just gives me a chill. I can feel the snow. Then it's a successful painting. It's not about the details, painting every leaf on the tree or something. It's about getting the feel of a mm-hmm. specific scene, if it's morning light or evening light or whatever. If it's a bale of hay that reminds someone of their childhood, then it's a successful painting in my book.
So if you look at those successful paintings that have accrued in your studio or in a gallery, is it a catalog of your emotional state? Can you look at an old painting and say, okay, well, that day I remember because I broke up with that girl, whatever
well,
it is.
Yeah, well, it's funny you should say that, because in my studio, there are literally thousands of paintings. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I paint pretty much every day. So I can go back into my studio and pull a painting out of a stack. I can't tell you what year I painted it, but it takes me right back to that spot. And I've had my wife say, oh, wow, where's that? And it's just a tree on a road. And I'll say, oh, that's such and such road up out of Carbondale. And she'll go, how do you remember that? Because you're exactly right. I stood there. I studied it. I mean, I analyzed it. I agonized over it. I made a painting out of it. So they resonate on a different level with me.
Huh. Do you paint right away when you set up in a place?
The system I have, what I learned early on, I was an illustrator before I started doing fine art, and I had a whole studio full of stuff, and when I started going outside, I realized you have to pare that down to the essentials, because as you can imagine, the light lasts. I mean, it moves quickly. So you learn to grab what you need quickly. You learn to analyze what's going to change, what's going to stay the same, what you have to get, you have to get down. For example, the shadows that are moving on a hillside. You know you may only have, 10 minutes before they change. So you learn to work very quickly. So the gear I have, when I'm driving down the road and I see something I want to paint, I'm set up and painting within minutes. And then 6 or 7 minutes, I'm actually painting, and that's come from experience.
Photographers revere the slanting light, the low light, when the sun is low at either end of the sky. Is it the same for you? Can
absolutely.
You make a good painting?
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely the best. It's actually easier, to put it honestly with you, because you have the more dramatic light. You have those more obvious things. So I tend to paint early and late a lot, but I also like the challenge of high noon, where there's no shadows. Can you get that washed out feel of a hot summer day where there's no shadows to, judge the light on? So yes, it is easier in the evening or the afternoon, but I like the challenge of painting all day. Now, the heat and the cold I don't deal with as well as I used to, but
Do you paint over canvases? Do you start a painting and then paint over it after it's dry?
I usually, if the horse dies and I need to get off, I scrape it. I rarely, if it's a failure, it's a failure.
Uh-huh.
But it's not to say I've been playing around in the studio. There's a big difference between working in the studio and working in the field. There are times in the studio where I may pull out a painting that was a failure that has no use to me, and I may sand areas down and paint over it. I do that. But I rarely also change something I've started working on outside. When I go back in the studio, early on, I thought, well, I can fix that, and I can fix this, and I ruined more paintings than I ever fixed. So I have a different approach now. When I go back in the studio and I pull paintings out that I've done outside, I rarely make major changes. I may, if I've got two trees that look similar, I may do some tweaking, but I tend to not repaint things. I leave them as they are. And even if they're not necessarily successful painting, there may be a passage in there that I really nailed the color and value, some notes, if you will, that really are more beneficial than the way too many photographs I take.
Oh, so you're taking photos too?
Oh, yeah, I definitely. Digital has been both good and bad. The beauty of digital, I take pictures.
Huh. How many paintings are failures? What's your failure?
I will say that as I've hopefully matured as an artist, you have a lot more tools, if you will, in your toolbox. You have a lot more knowledge. So I have a tendency that I could save paintings. I'll be honest with you, pretty much every painting I do to this day, I get to that point where I go, this isn't happening. So I have to separate myself, take a breather, come back, and in most cases, I can analyze it, by going into my toolbox, if you will, and figuring out where I went off track. Huh. And I can usually save them, and if not, I scrape them and move on.
Huh.
So, you know, my success rate is probably better than what it used to be, but also my bar, my standards have been raised.
Uh-huh.
So painting that I do now, 10 years ago, one that I might wipe may have been a real gem 10 years ago. Huh. Which is a healthy thing. I think you need to improve, always be a student.
Yeah. What are you learning these days with painting?
Actually, I've been playing around with more trying to simplify things and play more with the texture of paint. You know, believe it or not, it's frustrating when someone says, oh, I love your painting. It looks like a photograph. Well, that's not what I want to do as an artist. I want it to look like a painting. I want it to look like something Dan Young created. So that evolves over time. I've always used that phrase, I can't paint better than I know. So as my career has evolved, I'm able to handle more difficult subjects, and I'm trying to, believe it or not, simplify things, get down to the essence of the subject and leave as many details out as possible. And even though it sounds easier, it's actually harder.
You know, I think that feeling and that process probably takes place in all arts.
I hope so. Oh, absolutely.
I hear that from musicians that I've talked to, authors, same thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, right away, there's too many words.
And yep. What's the least number of words I can say this in? I feel the same way. What's the least number of strokes I can put on this painting to give the viewer enough information that they can be involved in the process?
So theoretically, 20 years from now, let's say, there won't be any failures. You'll nail it every time. Right.
We can hope, you know, we can hope. And it's funny, as long as I've been doing this, I still fail. I still go out and just do bad paintings. And unfortunately, and I'm sure all artists will tell you this, it's not really artist block. Some days you just can't get with the program.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating. I make my living as an artist. I'm very fortunate. But I still have bad days, and I'm driving home, and I look over and say, oh, McDonald's is hiring. Good. There's still hope. I'll be okay. And this is after 30 years. So.
How did you get to that point that you're making a good living from it? What was the process for you?
And I started, like I mentioned earlier, I was a commercial illustrator. When you're a commercial illustrator, you have clients that call you up and say, Dan, we want this illustration of this product. And they were willing to pay me well for it. When I jumped off, I think it was about 88, decided I was going to move home to Colorado, I brought some of my clients with me, so I was fortunate. I was working through FedEx. I mean, I still had work, and I started painting. When you're painting fine art like I am, you have to be able to market it. And today, the best place, or at least at that time, the best place to market was through art galleries. So I started putting work in art galleries. The big difference was nobody needed my paintings. When I was illustrating, there was a client at the end that was willing to pay me for the product I delivered. When you're doing fine art, that's not there. So part of you wants to paint what's true to you, but the other part of you really wants to pay the mortgage. So it's a balance of how you do that, and it takes time. It really does. I did the starving artist thing for a while, and I didn't enjoy it that much. But the more I did it, when it became a full-time job painting, I improved rapidly. Mm. And then slowly you get in an art gallery, and as your work improves, collectors start to notice you, and it sort of builds on itself. It's like the snowball rolling down the hill or a wave. I mean, over time, it builds, and you hope to keep that momentum going.
Is the internet useful?
The internet changed it dramatically. When it first came online, I think collectors were kind of leery to buy something online. It was new. So I would get a lot of interest in looky-loos, and, you know, I would get emails. Well, over time, as it's become more common, people are more willing to buy a painting online. I mean, the price point of my paintings are high enough that when someone buys one, they're a collector. You know, so if they know my work, that's one thing. But when I have somebody who I don't know, you know, contact me on the internet, it always impresses me that they're willing to buy something, spend that kind of money having never seen it. So it has changed the game, and all the galleries now have really been forced to get online and to also pursue it. Social media has changed it. It's definitely a different animal.
And yet, you have a gallery opening last night.
Absolutely.
So they're still critical.
I'm very hopeful that brick and mortars will survive. I think, personally, it gives me the opportunity to meet the collectors that buy my paintings.
Oh.
And I think that's huge. I enjoy that. There's nothing better than opening the opening last night. I had several collectors that I haven't communicated with in years that showed up and said, you know, I bought that painting of yours 20 years ago. I still love looking at it every day. That's huge. Uh-huh. I mean, it's nice to have that personal touch, and I hope that continues. You know, I mean, I hope the galleries are able to survive.
That's heartening to hear that, because I hear the same thing from artists, musicians.
Absolutely.
Rather. You know, it's all, yeah, they go in the studio, they record their CD, but it's still all about the live show.
Mm-hmm.
And
it
it's
is.
The same kind of thing.
It absolutely is. Yeah. I mean, I've made some very dear friends that are collectors of mine that over time, it opens wonderful doors to me. It gets me on property that I couldn't get on. It's a huge part of what I do that I hope never goes away. Hmm. You know, the big challenge is I actually just had dinner a couple of weeks ago with some young musicians, actually, two young kids that were just getting started. And it was interesting talking to them about doing the whole social media thing, the amount of effort they have to do to get recognized. Here I am, as I consider myself an old guy, going, I don't want to play. I want to paint my pictures. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to play the social media. I don't want to have to try to sell online. That's what I have the galleries for. Mm-hmm. So I'm very hopeful that they can survive.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. What's next for Dan Young?
Another painting.
Yeah. Yeah. One by one by one.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm fortunate that I absolutely love what I do.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I go painting, it's a good day.
Huh. And I'm guessing that ethic shows itself in your paintings.
I think so. You know, I'm very fortunate that my father lived long enough to see me have success. I mean, my father was old school, you know, ran his own business for years. And when I told him I was going to go to art school, of course, he's like, well, whatever. You know, there's the door. Here's some suitcase. That's your graduation present. He lived long enough to see some of my very successful shows. And that was encouraging. And that's one of the things he said, you work very hard for what you did. You know, I mean, I wasn't this totally gifted artist that it all fell in my lap. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this for 30 years hard. It is my job. Mm-hmm. So I'm fortunate, but I think I've earned some of it.
Well, yeah, it's obvious to me from the website. You might want to check that out, dear listener, danyoungstudio.com, or go up to Cora Logos Gallery in Basalt and
absolutely.
Check it out. I guess that show hangs until September 3rd.
Yes, correct.
Great. Dan Young, thanks for joining the program today.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I did too. Beppe Gambetta from Milano via Jersey traveled to express yourself on September 26th, 2014 and performed Margheritine before his gig at Steve's Guitars and proved that he is as good a singer as he is a guitar player.
Margaritin, quan que el fa fred, qui l'avansta la vie, avansta la vie. Sun novio deis que estan a pres, margaritin, quan que el fa fred, quan que el fa fred. Tu, 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 tu. Na 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 na. Due belle gambe, una bella vita. Troverei pa candela più dritta, candela più dritta. Troverei pa cunia tirin, più bella figlia de Margaritin. Do 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 na 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 na